and we are actually inviting oppressive regimes and dictatorships to come and buy this weaponry, knowing that it will be used against the people of Palestine, knowing it's going to be dropped on the heads of the people of Yemen, is appalling.
In recent years, short of 60% of British arms exports have gone to the Middle East, accounting for billions of dollars in sales. Most of that business has gone to Saudi Arabia, which, according to many rights groups, has killed hundreds of thousands of civilians in indiscriminate airstrikes in Yemen.
Since 2015, the UK government has approved hundreds of arms export licenses to Saudi Arabia worth more than $9 billion. Of that figure, nearly $2 billion came between July and September last year, after a court here rejected a legal challenge to ban weapon sales to the kingdom, a move slammed by critics as immoral.
The UK also sells record amounts of arms to Israel, lending support to Tel Aviv's militarized repression of Palestinians. Campaigners in Britain's political opposition are calling for an immediate change in government policy. But while they point out a shift in public opinion in recent years, the arms fair and the multi-billion dollar worldwide industry that drives it shows every sign of growing. Saeed Pariza, London.
The Taliban spokesman has declared the collapse of Panjshir Valley in the north of Kabul. Zabihullah Mujahid says the war is over in Afghanistan and that there is no anti-Taliban resistance in the country, except by Daesh.
The war is ended all over Afghanistan after successfully capturing Panjshir province as the last stronghold for the ousted enemy. The Islamic Emirate forces have active presence in the valley.
However, the leader of National Resistance Front says he is in Panjshir and that his forces are deployed across the strategic areas of the valley. According to Massoud, the resistance will push ahead with its fight on the Taliban until victory is achieved. In an audio message, Massoud called on all Afghans to come together and stand against the Taliban.
I call on all my countrymen inside and abroad to launch a national uprising to defend our dignity, independence and freedom. I also call on the international community to be aware that the Taliban has never changed.
The leader of National Resistance Front also slammed the Taliban for what he called defying the demand of a top delegation of religious scholars to engage in talks to resolve the conflict in Panjshir. He also accused Pakistan of directly invading Afghanistan, saying the Pakistani military used drones to bomb Panjshir to help the Taliban. Ahmed Massoud's claim on the Pakistani military interference in Panjshir has complicated the situation. On Monday, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman was asked about the reports of Pakistani airstrikes. The spokesman said Iran condemns all foreign interference in Afghanistan without specifying any country. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
A two-day meeting of G20 health ministers wrapped up in the Italian capital on Monday, ensuring sustainable development in a post-pandemic world and preventing future pandemics were among the issues discussed by the group. At the end of the meeting, Roberto Speranza, the health minister of Italy, which holds the G20 presidency this year, announced the unanimous adoption of the Pact of Rome and the pledge that the group of 20 will make sure the world's population has access to COVID-19 vaccines.
Ma dobbiamo necessariamente rendere altre aree del mondo.
We want to build the conditions to make it possible to take the COVID-19 vaccines to the most fragile countries. Furthermore, with the Pact of Rome, it was decided to make a commitment to reinforce the health systems.
Now that public health and social measures have been relaxed in many countries, COVID vaccination rates have slumped in some parts of the world, and authorities are worried. G20 health ministers have stressed that the public's vaccination is crucial.
The G20 talks have taken place against the backdrop of a flaming debate over the so-called Green Pass, a mandatory proof of anti-COVID vaccination. The Italian government is considering extending its Green Pass to all employees in the public sector, but part of the ruling coalition is against it.
The Italian government has already made the Green Pass mandatory for school staff and for passengers on long-distance public transport. This has prompted a swath of protests across Italy over the past months. About 37.5 million Italians, out of a population of less than 60 million, have received both COVID vaccine doses so far. Italian authorities aim at vaccinating 80% of the population by the end of September, a target that seems unlikely to be met. Max Civili, Rome.
The EU Rule of Law Report 2021 singles out Hungary, Poland, Bulgaria, Croatia and Slovenia for particular criticism. It reaches conclusions but provides zero recommendations.
It's toothless and spineless because what we have is a carefully worded partial account of threats to the rule of law without any joining of the dots, without any calling things out as they are.
The European Commission's Rule of Law report was published in July. This is the first opportunity members of the European Parliament, MEPs, have had to debate it. Some governments in the EU are accused of corruption, stifling media freedom, and interfering in judicial systems.
Such as Austria, for example, where public prosecutors responsible for high-profile corruption cases have been confronted with negative portrayals by government representatives.
Calls have been made for EU funding to be withheld.
No money from the recovery plan can be used by these oligarchs to further capture the state and further organise elections in their favour. We should be very, very serious about that.
Far-right EU lawmakers were criticised during the debate.
You protect a Hungarian autocrat who gives money to everywhere there in dark channels in corruption.
Legislators say EU governments are failing to ensure human rights and promote religious tolerance. It's a particular issue for Jews and Muslims.
For me, Muslims are two times victims. One, as a citizen like you and me, but secondly, because their religion is hijacked by extremists to make a horrible thing of it.
The European Commission has powers to enforce rule of law, but is accused of not using them.
It is a problem for all of us. It's a problem because this spreads. And also, it's a problem when the Commission doesn't manage to act properly.
Some MEPs are asking the question, why is it EU leaders are so quick to apply sanctions on foreign nations for alleged rule of law breaches, but turn a blind eye when one of their own nations steps out of line? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Lebanon is in a day of national mourning after the passing of head of the Supreme Islamic Shiite Council in Lebanon at the age of 85. Sheikh Abdel Amir Qabalan was viewed by those who knew him as not only a religious figure, but a national figure who strove for the best interest of the country.
Lebanon's problem doesn't lie in its religious or sectarian diversity, but in some corrupt officials who hide behind their sects and call on their followers to move away from their genuine belief. Sheikh Qabalan, along with other clerics, exerted all efforts to keep the sectarian diversity as national treasure. Lebanon cannot be a transit area for the Zionists or the U.S. It should be a symbol of resistance and national pride as he wanted.
The deceased cleric was known for his moderation and therefore his impact on mediating talks between Lebanese political groups.
The demise of Sheikh Qabalan comes at a critical time for Lebanon, which is unprecedented in Lebanon's history. Lebanon needs such figures at this stage. He was someone open to all sides in Lebanon, whether political or religious. He had always called for solving our internal crisis peacefully. Also, he was a supporter of the resistance.
In a statement, the Speaker of the Parliament, Nabih Birri, stressed that Ayatollah Qabalan followed in the footsteps of Imam Musa Sadr in moderation, coexistence, and resisting deprivation and occupation.
Ayatollah Sheikh Qabalan's demise is a great loss for Lebanon and the Muslim world. We all know he was among the close companions of Sayyid Musa al-Sadr, and together they worked for the poor and the oppressed. They established the Supreme Islamic Shiite Council, which serves as a center for congregation and dialogue for all Lebanese. We pray that this sad occasion could push the Lebanese officials to put differences aside and quickly form a cabinet, since Lebanon is in dire need for an active government.
Caretaker Prime Minister Hassan Diab declared Tuesday the day of the funeral procession for the spiritual leader as a national holiday. Throughout his life, Sheikh Kabbalan called on everyone to preserve the resistance in Lebanon and Palestine. He also preached unity among the Lebanese and Muslims, a move which made him a mediator on many occasions. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
As the world battles extraordinary refugee crisis for decades, hundreds of Afghans who have arrived in India after the Taliban take over of their country. They have been protesting outside the UN refugee office in New Delhi, demanding refugee status, justice, and protection for their women and children. Experts say India is not a signatory to the 1951 UN Refugee Convention or the 1967 protocols relating to the status of refugees. Therefore, it would be a challenging task to deal with another refugee influx. In India, where internal migration has been one of the most challenging tasks for the country due to huge population and possible mismanagement of the refugee policies. Observers say another refugee exodus could be a hard job for the country, considering its complex bureaucratic registration process. They say the country needs a uniform refugee policy. As India has no specific program for refugees, it allows the UNHCR to operate a program for them. Based on reports, thousands of Afghans are registered with the UN Refugee Agency, but there are many who are still demanding the refugee status despite arriving in India a decade ago. Experts say now the new influx might compel India to rethink its refugee policy.
Like many other nations and countries, India is home to a large group of and large chunk of refugees who come from their countries of origin to seek protection. But the confusion arises when we come to the mechanism, how India governs its refugees. In India, they have not a sound mechanism which can deal and which can protect these minorities.
A decade ago, scores of Afghan refugees arrived in India, leaving their war-torn country, but they still have trouble in accessing basic services like education, healthcare, and employment. Many are now demanding financial assistance due to lack of income. Others say they would return to their country, but are skeptical and still reeling from the violent past.
I think we have no future as the whole world is silent on our plight. The memories of violence still haunts us. I have a refugee card, but it does not help me as it should as a refugee. I urge the UN and the international community to pay urgent attention to us. We are worried for our future as our fate remains uncertain.
Despite India's rich history of ties with Afghanistan and home to hundreds of thousands of refugees from across the globe, the country has no clear-cut policy for refugees or any domestic law. Experts say by framing a concrete refugee law, India would be able to appropriately protect the rights of refugees. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Talks over the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal have faced a three-month hiatus following Iranian elections in June that brought Ebrahim Raisi to power. The European parties to the multilateral accord are now urging Iran to come back to negotiations. The new Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, says resuming the talks is on his agenda, but that they should not be held under Western pressure, and the U.S. must first lift all its sanctions against Iran.
We'll never run away from negotiations, but what the Westerners are trying to do, what Americans are trying to do, what they're pursuing is that they want to apply pressure. I mean, you could either have talks and dialogue, but at the same time, if you have pressure, what kind of negotiations are they? I mean, we need to have negotiations without pressure. That's not negotiation with pressure. So the threats that they're making against our people, these brutal sanctions, economic sanctions that they have imposed, this is not the issue of negotiations that we're talking about.
Six rounds of talks on restoring the deal have so far been held in Austria's capital, Vienna, since April. The discussions are aimed at bringing the U.S. and Iran back to full compliance after Washington unilaterally abandoned the deal, and Tehran retaliated by scaling back its own commitments. The U.S. seeks a broader deal that would include Iran's missile program. But Tehran doesn't buy any such notion as negotiation for the sake of negotiation, says Iran's foreign ministry spokesman in his weekly briefing.
The Vienna talks are aimed at ensuring Iran's rights under the nuclear deal.
which were violated by the U.S. lack of commitment and Europe's inaction toward the deal. So we are not negotiating a new deal.
Under the deal signed in 2015 between Iran and the six world powers, Tehran agreed to curb its nuclear activities in exchange for sanctions relief. In 2018, ex-U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew his country from the deal and reinstated sanctions on Iran. Tehran, in return, moved away from some of its obligations and resumed uranium enrichment to 20% purity. In the Vienna talks, Tehran vowed to reverse all of its retaliatory steps on the condition that Washington removes all its anti-Iran sanctions.
The new Iranian administration has not given any specific date as to when it will return to the Vienna talks. But what's clear is that the fate of the nuclear deal is equally important for Raisi as it was for the previous government. Except it's not the first priority for the new Iranian president, as he doubts the U.S.'s sincerity in lifting the sanctions after six rounds of fruitless talks. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Another wide-scale operation was launched by the Yemeni army against the oil giant Aramco in several areas in Saudi Arabia. The spokesman of the Yemeni army said Yemen's air force has successfully targeted Aramco's oil facilities in Ras Tanura in Dammam with eight drones of Samad 3 type and a ballistic missile.
Our forces have targeted Aramco oil facilities in Ras Tanura in the Dammam region, eastern Saudi Arabia, with eight Samad 3 drones and a Zulfiqar ballistic missile.
Saria also added that Aramco's facilities in Jeddah, Jazan, and Najran were also successfully hit by five ballistic missiles and two drones of Samad 3 type. He then warned Riyadh against further attacks until the war on Yemen is stopped. Earlier, Saudi officials said they had intercepted ballistic missiles targeting eastern province as well as the cities of Najran and Jazan in the south. The attacks came in response to the years-long Saudi aggression against Yemen.
Yemen's army has no way but to intensify its attacks against Saudi Arabia amid the kingdom's aggression against the impoverished nation. Saudi Arabia uses all capabilities, targeting civilian areas in Yemen, destroying the country's infrastructures. The latest attacks by the Yemeni army serve as a tit-for-tat operation.
Saudi Arabia launched a deadly war against Yemen in March 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children, and displacing millions more.
People here hailed the Yemeni army for its retaliatory attacks on Saudi Arabia. They say Saudi Arabia will remain a legitimate target for them as long as it continues its aggression against the impoverished nation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Michael McCall, the top Republican on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, said that the situation in Afghanistan is worse than before the September 11 terrorist attacks because the Taliban are fully armed with American weaponry. Here we present you an article concerning this issue by staff writers of France Press News Agency under the heading Biden under pressure as NGO says flights from Afghanistan blocked. The article was published by The Guardian Daily. Please stay with us to hear more about the story. Joe Biden administration is facing mounting pressure amid reports that several hundred people, including Americans, had been prevented for a week from flying out of an airport in northern Afghanistan. Marina Lee Gree, the founder and executive director of a small American NGO active in Afghanistan, said 600 to 1,300 people, including girls from her group, had been waiting near the Mazar-e-Sharif airport for as long as a week amid confusion involving the Taliban and U.S. officials. That number is understood to include 19 Americans, though none are with Lee Gree's group. She said those waiting are being housed in various places in the city. Lee Gree told AFE it's been several days and nothing is moving, adding that six chartered planes were waiting at the airport to evacuate what some officials are calling the NGO group. Taliban are simply not letting anything move. Her Virginia-based organization, which supposedly trains Afghan girls in leadership through physical activities like mountain climbing, is trying to evacuate a small group of girls and young women aged 16 to 23 and a few family members. All are Hazara, an ethnic minority in Afghanistan that faced severe repression when the Taliban last controlled the country from 1996 to 2001. Lee Gree, who has worked in Afghanistan since 2005 for U.S. agencies, expressed frustration with the role of the State Department in clearing the flights. The group's departure had seemed imminent until a few days ago when planning suddenly stopped. A State Department spokesperson said recently that while the U.S. is committed to helping Americans and at-risk Afghans leave, its resources in Afghanistan are seriously limited. The spokesperson told AFP, "We do not have personnel on the ground. We do not have air assets in the country. We do not have control the airspace, whether over Afghanistan or elsewhere in the region." The spokesperson noted, "Given these constraints, we also do not have a reliable means to confirm the basic details of charter flights, including who may be organizing them, the number of U.S. citizens and other priority groups on board, the accuracy of the rest of the manifest, and where they plan to land," adding, "We will hold the Taliban to its pledge to let people freely depart Afghanistan." Satellite images of the airport from September 3rd show six aircraft, one on a runway and others outside terminal buildings. Biden's Republican opposition has seized on the situation, which comes at a time when his popularity has fallen sharply amid concerns about the Afghanistan evacuation and the summer surge in COVID-19 cases. Michael McCaul, the top Republican on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, suggested on Sunday, September 5th, that the Taliban was holding the group as part of the high-pressure negotiations with Washington. But Lee Gree said she would not characterize the situation that way. She said nobody is guarding the door, even if her concern has grown as days pass. She said, "If it isn't resolved very soon, we are worried for the physical safety of our girls." Eric Montalvo, a former U.S. Marine Corps officer and a lawyer working with groups that chartered two of the six planes, said, "Taliban is now holding these planes hostage. The problem is the U.S. government. All the State Department has to do is to make a phone call and these people will be able to leave immediately." McCaul said hundreds of American citizens are still in Afghanistan, but Secretary of State Antony Blinken recently claimed under 200 and likely closer to 100 American citizens were still in the country. Speaking to reporters on Friday, September 3rd, Blinken said that the department was in constant contact with Americans in Afghanistan still and want to leave. He noted, "Most of the remaining American citizens are dual nationals whose home is Afghanistan and whose extended families live there. So it's no surprise that deciding whether or not to leave the place they call home is a wrenching decision." Meanwhile, White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain estimated on Sunday, September 5th, that about 100 Americans were still left in Afghanistan waiting to be evacuated by U.S. forces. Klain told CNN, "We believe it's around 100. We are in touch with all of them who we have identified on a regular basis." He claimed, "Obviously, we are hopeful that in the coming days, the Qataris will be able to resume air service out of Kabul. And if they do, we are obviously going to look to see if Americans can be part of those flights. We are going to find ways to get them, the ones that want to leave, to get them out of Afghanistan." Some rescue groups told the media that they are concerned that some Americans and individuals are missing from the White House's count of people who are waiting to be evacuated. The U.S. completed its military withdrawal from Afghanistan on August 31st after weeks of chaos after the Taliban's rapid takeover of the country. More than 120,000 people were flown out of Afghanistan in one of the largest such aerial operations in history. Though U.S. officials acknowledged having left a few hundred Americans behind, along with many vulnerable Afghans. The Biden administration has repeatedly claimed to do everything possible to help those who want to leave. On Monday, September 6th, the State Department announced that four American citizens had been able to leave Afghanistan by road, arriving in an unnamed neighboring country without any resistance from the Taliban. They were the first officially acknowledged U.S. departures since August 31st. The Taliban are poised to run Afghanistan again 20 years after they were removed from power by American occupation forces following the suspicious September 11, 2001 attacks on the United States. The U.S. invaded Afghanistan in October 2001 and removed the Taliban from power. American forces occupied the country for about two decades on the pretext of fighting against the Taliban, but as the U.S. forces left Afghanistan, the Taliban stormed Kabul, weakened by continued foreign occupation. McCall also said the situation in Afghanistan is worse than before the September 11 terrorist attacks because the Taliban are fully armed with American weaponry. McCall said, "We're going to back to pre-9/11 right now, but it's worse. It's worse because now they're fully armed with our weapons, our helicopters, and pallets of our cash." He added America's capabilities to deal with the terror threat are greatly exaggerated because Afghanistan is landlocked and surrounded by enemies that have now been emboldened by this foreign policy blunder. He also said that officials have to establish that ISR, or Intelligence Surveillance Reconnaissance, you know, somewhere over the horizon capability means flying from the Persian Gulf, probably countries like Qatar, which would be, you know, anywhere from 6 to 8 hours. Having to fly, you know, over Pakistan, yet refueling.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to the Spotlight. It is one of the biggest and most important yet maybe embarrassing jailbreaks. Six Palestinian prisoners escaping Israeli jail through a tunnel. Now the Palestinian men who escaped the jail are seen as heroes, embarrassing for Israel since they were able to escape a high security Israeli jail, breaking the myth that Israeli prisons are inescapable. Meanwhile, Palestinians are holding them as heroes. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at how this escape is emblematic of a major breakthrough in Israel's so-called invincibility, especially when it comes to its prisons and how this will embolden other Palestinians to stand up to the Israeli regime.
How
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have celebrated the escape of six Palestinian inmates from Israeli maximum security Jabal prison in north of the occupied territories through a tunnel dug in the floor. Palestinians hailed the heroic operation and handed out candies to celebrate what they call a heroic move. Palestinian factions consider the escape as a slap in the face of the Israeli regime.
This operation is a great victory for our Palestinian prisoners, the resistance, and our Palestinian people. What happened in Jalbo prison is unique. Our inmates grabbed their freedom by themselves, leaving the Israeli security defeated and confused. We are celebrating this victory as we call on all Palestinians to provide safety for those inmates.
Prisoners' groups said four of the inmates were serving life sentences. Another man was held under a special detention order, and the sixth was awaiting a verdict. Five of them belong to the Islamic Jihad movement, and one is a former commander in Fatah Party.
This escape has damaged the image of the Israeli regime before the world. It is such a great victory for Palestinians. We warn the Israeli regime against doing any action that puts the lives of those heroes at risk.
Palestinian resistance movements emphasized that the struggle for freedom with the Israeli occupation persists both behind bars and outside.
This is the biggest prison break in the history of the Palestinian cause, and it's going to be a remarkable incident in history. As Palestinian resistance, we hail these inmates' efforts of grabbing back their freedom and breaking the Israeli chains. We warn Israel not to hurt those prisoners, or else this will cost the Israeli regime a lot.
Palestinians have praised the heroic escape of the Palestinian inmates, describing it a blow to the Israeli regime and its security. They also stressed that the resistance is the only way to defend their rights and liberate their lands. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Let me introduce our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight. We have Charlotte Cates. She's an international coordinator at Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, who joins us from Vancouver. We also have Mick Napier, activist for Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, who joins us from Edinburgh.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. And Charlotte Cates, let me first start with you. Looking at this Gilboa prison is the name, a high security facility that's located in northern Israel. And it's called the Safe. And yet you have the six Palestinian prisoners who escaped this prison. Does this constitute a rare humiliation for the Israeli security apparatus?
I think what this constitutes is an exposure of the lie that the technical advantage granted to the Israeli occupation by the unlimited financial and military support granted to it by the United States and other Western powers is actually an advantage that's able to stop Palestinian resistance. So certainly it's exposing the weakness and the rottenness at the core of the Israeli occupation over Palestine through the courage, steadfastness, and kind of humanity of Palestinian political prisoners. And so it shows that there is always hope for freedom and that oppressive systems are doomed to failure. So certainly, this is a moment of humiliation for the Israeli occupation. It's also a sign of just how steadfast, resistant, and committed Palestinians are to obtain their freedom despite all the most difficult circumstances.
So the two vantage points that we have, McNabb, here, and I'm wondering which one you agree with. One from Israel itself, who said that the prison service, that this is based on an Israeli prison service official, who said the escape was a major security and intelligence failure. And then from the Palestinian groups, you have them saying that this was a heroic act that took place. How do you see this, McNabb, here?
I think in any colonial situation, the colonizer invariably has a massive technological advantage, whether in methods of killing or in methods of repression. But what determines the outcome, whether it's Algeria or Vietnam or even Afghanistan, is not that technological overwhelming superiority. It's the determination of indigenous people to persist and to resist, to absorb the terrible punishment that is inflicted upon them, in every colonial situation, and still to resist. And you know, in a struggle for existence, which the Palestinians are engaged in, morale is absolutely critical. It's not even weapons, it's not anything other than morale. And Palestinian morale took a huge leap during the recent Israeli attacks on Al-Aqsa Mosque and throwing Palestinian families onto the street in East Jerusalem and fascist gangs attacking Palestinians across 48 Israel. And the resistance that came from across the entire land surface of Palestine, the rockets from Gaza, the determination everywhere, forged a new sense of national unity and a readiness to resist. This is another. It's absolutely a disaster for the Israelis because they rely upon weapons that can kill to deter any opposition. And they also rely upon weapons of mass surveillance in order to crush the possibility of resistance. And you know, I think the Israeli salesmen who travel the world selling their grisly goods based on the fact that they've been tested on Palestinians and have been successful against Palestinians, their job in selling just became a little bit harder because armed with a rusty spoon, these six men got out of the safe. And now it's become a national struggle because the honor of protecting these men from Islamic Jihad and from Fatah, and I'm not sure if there was any from Hamas, but nonetheless, you know, the honor of protecting and defending these men from the Israeli dragnet means it's a national struggle. And we hope they can escape into Jordan or somewhere else, but even if they can't, Israel has already been dealt yet another blow. And you know, recently when one of the killers on the Gaza border, and you know, they had been killing literally hundreds of unarmed Palestinians. Recently, when a fighter from Gaza managed to kill the killer, the Israeli government went into a kind of crisis. This has deepened their crisis, and I think once again has raised the morale of the Palestinian people. They still have a terrible price to pay to win their freedom, but this means their call upon international community is much, much louder.
Uh-huh. Well, Charlotte Cates, let's take a look at the six prisoners in terms of what charges were brought against them or not. And I say or not because we're looking at this policy that Israel has called administrative detention, where you have one definition says administrative detention is a preemptive measure that allows authorities to detain, Israeli authorities to detain suspects before trial. Then you have the other definition of this in which it's basically stating that, let me bring this up, it's incarceration without trial or charge, alleging that a person plans to commit a future offense. And that is how many Palestinians actually get imprisoned, without committing something, but only suspicious that they may. Do you think that this process is legal?
No, I mean, administrative detention, which actually was introduced into occupied Palestine by the British colonial mandate and then was enthusiastically adopted by the Zionist regime, is routinely used by the Israeli occupation against Palestinians. There are currently approximately 4,650 Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli jails, and of those, over 500 are held without charge or trial in administrative detention. And it's important to note that when we speak about administrative detention, these orders are issued for up to 6 months at a time. However, they are indefinitely renewable. And so Palestinians routinely are jailed for years at a time with no charge, with no trial, with not even their lawyers being allowed to see what kind of alleged evidence there is against them on the basis of a so-called secret file. And this is absolutely illegal under international law. Even the elements of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which purport to allow for some forms of detention by an occupying power, do not allow for the routine and systematic use of administrative detention, which is absolutely what Israel has always practiced when it comes to Palestinians. The people who are targeted for administrative detention are community leaders, are freedom fighters, are organizers, are people who are looked to by their communities, by their villages, by their refugee camps, by their cities, as people who mobilize and defend Palestinian rights. And this is the entire reason why they are subject to arbitrary detention without charge or trial, something that is in complete violation of international humanitarian law and international human rights law, and something which is, right now, there are six Palestinian prisoners who are on hunger strike, one of them for nearly 2 months, in order to obtain their freedom from administrative detention, because administrative detention is also an element of psychological torture and collective punishment as well, because not only are you detained unjustly, not only are you detained by a colonial occupier, but you never know when you are going to be released or if you will ever be released. And your family is in that same situation as you. Many times families have prepared a dinner to welcome their loved one home from administrative detention, only to be told that he's not coming out because another 6 months administrative detention order is going to be slapped on him now. And so we see people like Ghassan Zawahra, community leader in Dahesha refugee camp, Kitan Safin, the president of the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, dozens of Palestinian university students. These are the people who are being held under administrative detention.
Well, Mick Napier, I'd also like to get your reaction on this because, as our guests there indicated, detainments take anywhere from several months being in prison to several years, and perhaps even a lot more than that without being charged, without telling them what they're being accused of. So give us your reaction to that. And I'm guessing that when this happens, well, what do you have? I mean, it's not like this happens once or twice a year. This is pretty much happening on a routine basis somewhat. You're getting a lot of Palestinians that keep accumulating in terms of their hate for the Israeli regime. They know that the Israeli regime is not liked, but when they get that experience, not only the one that's being imprisoned, but also their family members. So, it kind of goes against establishing Israeli security with this act.
Charlotte's right about administrative detention. It's internment. It's snatching people from their homes and off the street without a semblance of a trial, and jailing them indefinitely in 6 month stages. But you know, the entire system in Israel means the so-called justice system, but it means that no Palestinian who's now incarcerated had received a trial in the sense that we would understand it. The system has a record of 99.7% conviction rate. For a Palestinian in this military system to be found not guilty is as rare as snow in summer. It doesn't happen. Let's say 100% conviction rate. That means that when a Palestinian goes in front of this court, his chances are zero. Her chances are zero. The only thing they can do is play the system and plead guilty in order to receive a reduced sentence. If they do not plead guilty, they'll have a sentence greatly increased. The court procedures will be dragged out for years and years. I'm sorry, I forget the guy's name, but Mohammed, who's a humanitarian aid worker with World Vision in Gaza, is currently at the end of his fifth year awaiting trial on trumped-up charges of fraud, of which he is completely innocent, but he's in prison because he refuses to sign a false confession. That would be his only route out. He has been told if he signs the false confession, he can go free for time served. So the system is processing Palestinians like pieces of meat. They are not treated as humans, not by the court system and not by the staff in the court system. It only takes a Shin Bet guy sitting beside a so-called military judge to lean over and mutter the word security, and there's nothing the Palestinian can do. So this is not every single Palestinian in Israeli jails is a political prisoner. None of them has received a trial in the sense that we would understand it. It's a system of mass kidnapping and internment of thousands of people at any particular moment. And you know, a high-powered Zionist group of lawyers went to look at the court system in the West Bank several years ago and reported back to say it was indefensible. It was a system to terrorize Palestinians and to crush Palestinians into submission. That's from Zionist lawyers in London. So the truth is indisputable. These men who managed to dig their way out of Gilboa prison, they're just like the people who dug their way out of World War II prisons under Nazi Germany and any other brutally repressive regime. But you know something? The reason they won, the reason they got out, is because of the contempt and the racism with which Palestinians are dealt in the Israeli system, both popular racism and state racism.
Uh-huh.
Every Israeli learns that Palestinians are stupid or ugly or dirty or something horrible, and therefore they're treated with contempt. Well, now that contempt has led to these guys being able to get out of the safe. It's a tremendous slap in the face for this brutal system of mass incarceration, mass killing, mass house demolition, and a system, by the way, which Amnesty International says is characterized by systematic torture. So yeah, it's wonderful to see this. This is a time for parties and giving out sweets to your friends.
Right, and Charlotte Cates, our guest there, mentioned in the beginning that this is truly a booster for the morale of Palestinians. So when you and it's evidence based on the way the Palestinians have cheered this in the Gaza Strip and even in the occupied West Bank, and with the resistance groups coming out and really hailing this as a victory of sorts, you wouldn't think that this may have had that kind of impact, but it has had that impact. And this morale increase, how could that translate into what Palestinians' goals are when it comes to the Israeli regime in terms of trying to break the occupation and the different violations that occur there?
Well, this route through the Freedom Tunnel is in many ways a path to liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea. The Palestinian prisoners are so central to the Palestinian cause because they represent the resistance. They represent a true and uncompromised leadership of the Palestinian people, and they represent a real symbol of national unity that means more than just kind of discussions about governance or the Palestinian Authority, but instead are about the national unity that is obtained in fighting the occupation and resisting until victory. And so just as we talked about earlier, this shows that the technological superiority of the Israeli occupation can fall in the face of a determined indigenous resistance. And you know, this is what we've seen when the resistance on the ground has prevented the Israeli occupation from entering Gaza. This is certainly what we saw in Lebanon when the resistance of the people drove out the occupation and forced it to leave. That despite that, you know, $3.8 billion of weaponry given to Israel every year by the most powerful army in the world, the United States, that does not stop the people of Palestine, just as it did not stop the people of Lebanon from liberating themselves. And so these six Palestinian prisoners are symbols of hope. They are symbols of the fact that liberation is not an idle dream, that liberation is possible, that it can be obtained, and that it can be obtained through planning, through strategy, through resistance, and through organizing themselves. And that's also the message that the Palestinian prisoners' movement reflects as a whole. Right now, inside the prisons, there is an uprising going on. There are cells being burned in response to attacks by Israeli occupation forces. There are people taking to the streets throughout Palestine in support of these prisoners. So it's a moment of celebration, but it's also a moment of knowing that the struggle can be built and that victory can be achieved. And so it's also a symbol for everyone around the world who is looking for liberation, who is looking for justice, who is looking for freedom. These six men are representatives of the hope and the dreams of humanity in many ways. And so their continued freedom, the defense of them, and the mass embrace of the Palestinian people for the, not just these six Palestinian prisoners, but all of the nearly 5,000 held behind Israeli bars, reflects the fact that liberation is not only possible, but is in fact inevitable. But it can't come without all of us working, organizing, building the boycott of Israel, isolating the Israeli occupation regime, and building support and solidarity with the Palestinian people and their resistance.
Okay, final question to you. Going along the lines of what Charlotte Cates has said is obviously not something Israel wants to happen. So let's talk about the Israeli reaction here, what they're going to do. McNapier, as she mentioned, you got the Palestinian prisoners inside jails setting it on fire. Obviously, Israel doesn't want that. I'm guessing they're going to go out trying to crush this one way or another. It is said that their entrance into the Jenin refugee camp to look for the prisoners is imminent. There's going to be resistance there. Looking down further down the road, then are we looking at something happening between Palestinians and Israel because of this incident? How do you see it?
Well, Bennett, the Prime Minister, is an Arab killer. He said, "I've killed," quote, "he said, I've killed lots of Arabs. I don't have a problem with that." The Israelis will be looking for people to kill because they have to restore what they call their deterrent edge and also to repress. So, yes, the Israeli response will be bloody and violent. But this resistance will inspire people around the world. Solidarity is only possible if people resist. The more they resist, the more the solidarity can be delivered. And this is an inspiration. We will now go forward to build a campaign, to intensify the campaign to boycott and isolate the state of Israel, because the Palestinians have shown that even if the Abu Dhabi and Riyadh, Israeli team, Cairo, obviously Britain and America aligning with the Israeli regime, nonetheless, the Palestinian resistance has not been broken, even although it's possibly the most unequal situation of any anti-colonial struggle in history. They show that they can win. It's a symbol, and it will lead to victory.
Thank you. Thank you. Unfortunately, got to have to end it, McNapier, activist Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Charlotte Cates, thank you. International Coordinator of the Samidon Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network from Vancouver. That does it for this edition of The Spotlight. For me, Kevin Tahwe, it's goodbye. Until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.